You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen. There are two types of rebels. Rebels with a cause and those without one. I spent a chunk of my childhood as the latter. Breaking curfew, texting during class, stealing a box of Tic Tacs from the takeaway shop. I'm really sorry, I was 12, they were orange flavoured and I'd just watched the movie Juno. I really wanted to be like Pauly Bleeker. I'll never do it again, I swear. This week's episode is about the other type of rebels. Rebels with a cause. People who go against the expectations of society and even break the law in the pursuit of good. In our first story, Timothy's mum finds herself a dealer.
It might seem suspicious that my client had in his possession at the time of his arrest 24 pounds of marijuana.
Drugs are menacing our society. They're threatening our values and undercutting our institutions. They're killing our children.
It's better to cough. It's like, makes you 10 times more higher.
I actually remember when I was a teenager and I smoked weed for the first time, I honestly wondered whether I was the first person in my entire family to ever do it. Because that's just not how my family operates. Me and my family don't talk about drugs. So when Mum got sick last year, her and I came a lot closer. We're better friends now than we've ever been. When she reached a point where she needed medicinal cannabis, well, suddenly drugs became a topic of conversation in our family. It was brand new territory for us. I just thought Mum and I should get in a room and talk about it. I mean, this is a little strange, isn't it? Sitting here and talking about marijuana.
You're with your mum.
Yeah. I'm not sure I ever saw this day coming. I mean, it's not really common for our family, right?
No.
It's not.
No.
Drugs and that kind of a topic is not something that we discuss or really have ever discussed as a family. Mum, why don't you tell us a little bit about the last 12 months?
Okay. 12 months ago in August, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. It turned out to be an aggressive form of breast cancer called triple negative. I had a mastectomy and then started about 6 months of chemotherapy with the first drug that I was given, which was lasted about 2.5 months. That caused me severe nausea. Mm.
Well, what was your impression of marijuana as a drug when you were young or now as an adult?
Well, marijuana was something that I'd tried once, but because I didn't know how to smoke, I didn't know how to draw back a cigarette, I couldn't draw back the marijuana. So I thought, well, I'm not going to worry about this. So I never had any marijuana after that. It wasn't something that worried me in any way or form. I didn't really think much about it.
Right.
I was a bit worried about my children ever taking it because of the some of the side effects that have been known that can cause schizophrenia, etc. So that was the only worry I had about marijuana, really.
Right. And I mean, Grandpa's always been pretty strict. Was he sort of hounding you to stay away from drugs when you were young?
He was hounding me to stay away from everything.
Well, let's talk about your time with chemo. So what were some of those side effects? You said nausea. I mean, tell us about that.
Yeah, well, the nausea was the worst side effect. It was debilitating. It hit me within about 4 hours of taking the drug. I was, in fact, even when I went into the hospital, the cancer centre, even just to see a nurse or the oncologist, I started feeling nauseous.
Yeah, it's just association.
Yeah, it's just by association. Yeah. As soon as I saw the red drug in the needle that they were giving me, I felt sick. Yeah. But the real nausea hit me within 4 hours of being administered.
So basically you tried to get medicinal cannabis.
Yes.
And the doctor said, we need to try everything else.
That's
and by
right.
the time you had tried everything else, and well, you just never ended up getting it.
Well, by after having had three cycles of chemotherapy, the oncologist said he was going to apply for it for me.
Mm-hmm.
However, it never came through. So I never did see the medicinal marijuana.
What did you do instead then?
Well, I had a friend who had a friend who occasionally gave them some marijuana, which she would make marijuana cookies. And she had said when I told her that I had cancer, she said, "Oh, if I get some of my marijuana, I'll make you some special cookies." And it just so happened that after the third cycle, she had some, and she gave me the cookies. Now at that stage, I was on the cocktail of six, and not sleeping and feeling pretty terrible. And she said they were very weak. I took one. The first night I took one cookie. By the next day I had slept better, but I had already started to need less nausea tablets, mm-hmm. medication. Within 3 days I was off all of the medication and I was sleeping really well.
Yeah. And nausea?
The nausea was non-existent.
So Joy Lambert, who's the wife of this guy called Barry Lambert. Barry Lambert started the Lambert Initiative, which is a research facility and a research grant that he gave the Sydney University. And Joy Lambert said, "I just kept thinking you're allowed to be civilly disobedient for a good cause. Sometimes life takes you further than the law."
Mm.
I mean, what do you think about that?
I agree with that totally, yeah. If you're not hurting anybody else, if you need to do something to help yourself or to help somebody close to you, and it's not causing anybody else harm, well then, of course.
I mean, how did you feel when you sort of those kind of your breaking the law as an adult?
I was quite excited. I think I went back to my teens when I wasn't able to do that, or wasn't, I didn't actually do any of that stuff.
Hi, Tim.
Hi, Stephen. If
I'm
being honest,
Hi.
My original objective when I started doing this was to get to the bottom of why Mum wasn't able to get medicinal cannabis, you know, something that was perfectly legal, and why someone would have to be forced to find it illegally and, you know, break the law just to make yourself feel better.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
Okay. So I decided to call Mum's oncologist. I spoke to Dr. Della Fiorentino.
Cool. Well, thanks so much again for talking to me.
That's right.
Honestly, a part of me was hoping that he would tell me how insanely difficult the whole process of obtaining medicinal cannabis was for a doctor.
Is it time-consuming to monitor patients, or is it quite easy?
No, it's pretty easy. I mean, it's part of routine practice, particularly if someone's getting chemotherapy. We're doing other assessments for chemotherapy side effects. You know, the cannabis is around efficacy because you're hoping that the nausea is less, and then you can ask standard questions about side effects from the cannabis.
That mum was just one of thousands of people who fell through the cracks of a flawed system.
Under the special access scheme, it does state that you need to have exhausted basically every other medical possibility before you can go after an unregistered product. Is that a pretty long process?
Oh, no, not really, because I guess with chemotherapy, we try a lot of the anti-nausea stuff up front, so more and more we give people almost everything at the beginning and then...
The fact is, medicinal cannabis is legal in Australia. A lot of doctors don't feel comfortable prescribing it. Maybe a lot of patients can't afford it. Maybe it's not effective for some patients. Some doctors may not even believe in it, or, you know, have seen enough scientific evidence. And some patients may take part in clinical trials and get a placebo. Mum's story is only one of thousands in Australia. And I think now that maybe I was trying to get the wrong thing out of this experience. that the thing that ended up being more rewarding was talking to my family. So when I had the chance, I decided to sit down with my grandma. Okay, so I've just dragged away grandma from her 80th birthday celebration, and I've got mum here with me as well. I just wanted to ask you, grandma, how you felt when mum basically couldn't get medicinal cannabis legally and had to require some illegally.
Well, I was just delighted she couldn't require some illegally, because it seemed crazy that she's been given countless number of drugs that were doing absolutely no use at all, and chemicals going into her body which weren't helping, and a little bit, one cookie, and, you know, she was fixed almost. I think that would be right.
Yes, exactly.
So, you know, I'm not a believer in illegal drugs by any manner of means, but I think medicinally it's terribly important that they should be available to everyone who needs them.
I mean, I know how much having grandma's support with that helped you, Mum.
Yes, it did, yeah, exactly. It was important to me that everyone was behind me with it.
What would have been a punishment for the girls and Jace when they were younger if they had been caught smoking marijuana?
Just, it's unthinkable. I'm not saying necessarily saying from my point of view, but from their father's point of view, there was no way known that... I mean, what we didn't know was fine. I do have a problem with, because I think it's harmless to a lot of people, but it can be a very habit-forming situation, which leads to much harder drugs. And sure. You know, and I you know, we've had experience in family situation that that's happened. Mm. So you know, I think it's much better to be clear of it.
In Grandpa's final years, do you think medicinal cannabis would have been something that could have helped him?
Well, it may have, but there'd be no way he would. He wouldn't even smoke a cigarette. You know, he was so anti all those sort of things. So, I'm not sure what the situation with Parkinson's, whether there is any relief from it or not. I haven't heard that sort of side of things.
Mm. Okay, well, that's great. Well, that was nice and easy. I won't keep you. I know everybody out there celebrating you. So thanks for talking.
Extremely emotional today. I don't know whether Joey said to me or Kate said to me, you think it's because, you know, Dad's not here. You know, and so here I am going again, and yet I'm not really sort of in that situation. And I've only had half a small glass of wine, so I can't blame that.
It took death and cancer for me to become closer with two of the most important women in my life. Two of the people who shaped me into who I am today. If I could go back, I definitely wouldn't wait around for those awful things before I properly appreciated them.
That story was produced by Timothy Piccione. You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney. FBI is an independent organisation funded entirely by our community through a mix of sponsorship revenue and membership. With no live events to promote, we need your help. If you want to lend a hand, you can become an FBI supporter by visiting fbiradio.com/support. Charlie's dad was an Irishman from regional New South Wales. His mother was a proud Gurindji woman who was part of the Stolen Generation. Their relationship was pretty unconventional back in 1928, but their rebellious spirit is something that has carried on through generations. First to Charlie, and now to his daughter, Emma.
My dad was an incredible man, I must tell you. He came from a well-to-do family, born in Corowa, in New South Wales on the border, and his family were well-to-do. They owned the hotel. They owned a business. I think they own Burley underwear. I think they own that. So they were pretty well-to-do, and they were Irish people. And Dad had a sister, Myra, and he left home when he was 17. He wanted to be a bike rider, and he'd already shown good form in Corowa and Rutherglen and Albury and those other places around there that he was pretty good. So he got a chance to go to Melbourne and he joined the Sandringham Bike Club. This is about 1924. And whilst he was there, he met a man by the name of Bruce Small. Bruce had invented a bike, a Malvern Star bike. No gears, just a Malvern Star bike. And what he was looking for was someone to ride the bike around Australia and show just how good it was, because he was a businessman, entrepreneurial. He wanted to sell it and make it a really important bike that everyone wanted. And he stumbled across my dad, who was 19 at the time. And he said, "Jack, you're a good young bike rider. Would you be interested in riding this around Australia, this Malvern Star bike that I've just invented?" And Dad looked at it and he said, "Why not?" Now, he was away from home. He wasn't living with his family. And his friend Basil Nixon was another good bike rider, was at the Sandringham Club as well. So he said to Basil, "Do you want to ride with me and we'll ride around Australia?" And Basil, again, away from his family, said, "Yes, we will do it." So I've got to tell you, they agreed to ride the bike around Australia in 1926, so we're going to leave Melbourne. What John Richard King didn't know, as he got on that Malvern Star bike and headed north out of Melbourne towards Brisbane, it would be the last time he would see Melbourne. It would be the last time, was the last time he would see his family. He was on a journey that was going to take him to the Badlands, to here, to Darwin. He knew nothing about that. They just rode. So he and Basil left Melbourne on their ride. They headed towards Brisbane. The roads weren't too bad in 1926, so they made good time. They got to Brisbane. Basil never told Dad that he had a pistol in his pocket. He carried a pistol with him because he was afraid of Aboriginal people. He'd read somewhere they were cannibals and they had particular liking for non-Aboriginal people if they got hold of them. So he had the bike and he's had the gun in his pocket and they rode as far as they got to Brisbane. I'm going to pause there and go across to my mum. Ningardi was her name. She was born on Limbunya Station. Her father, as I said, was the white policeman. Her mother was named Tom. I said, why Tom, Mum? And she told me because she worked like a man, but the real reason she didn't tell me is that she couldn't say her name. She wouldn't say her name in respect of her mother. So her name was Tom and her dad's name was William. She was born there and then one day they arrived to take the children away and they took her and her sister Maggie and her cousin Auntie Daisy Ruddick and they put them on horses and they took them away from their people and they brought them to the Victoria River. They put them on a boat along the Victoria River out to the sea, around here to Darwin, and then probably here right behind me, they probably passed here on that motor launch with three kids in there, probably still shaking, probably still afraid, heading to Darwin, heading to an unknown future, down here to the wharf and taken from there to the Carlin compound. They might have the Anglican Church, which is over there. Probably wasn't there then, but some couple of years later, that's where John Richard King stood with his bike that he was riding and a spare bike trying to raise money to continue his journey around Australia. She didn't know that. He didn't know that. So she was at the Carlin compound. Let's go back to Brisbane. John and Basil are there. They point their bikes west and they head towards Mount Isa. The roads are still not too bad. And then they get to Mount Isa and now they've got to head north, as I said before, to the Badlands. No roads, just tracks. And they made pretty good time, even though it was pretty rough. And Basil, south of Catherine, fell off his bike. Went head over heels, landed on the ground. The gun went off. Shot him in the leg. So he had a bullet lodged in his thigh and his right leg. They're miles from anywhere. There's nothing they can do about it. He rode with the bullet in his leg from south of Catherine all the way to Darwin, with Dad trying to help him all the way, trying to stop bleeding, trying to do all the things. By the time he got here, it had turned gangrenous. They just couldn't do anything here, so they put him on a boat and sent him back to where he came from, back to Melbourne to do some work on it. So John Richard King, my dad, is left here with a bike, no money, no chance of going forward, can't go backwards. What can he do? So he tried desperately in front of the old Terminus Hotel to get someone to help him and raise some money. none of it was forthcoming. So in the end, this little Irishman with his red hair and his fair skin says, I'm going to have to work for a living. So he tried it. They were working on Ludmilla at that time. They were digging the roads. And so he worked there for them. Off came the shirt, working in the hot sun, and then he got sunstruck pretty badly and taken from there to the Royal Darwin Hospital. Meanwhile, Ningardi, whose now name was Ruby Jane Smith, had left Carlin Compound as she grew older and finished up at Royal Darwin Hospital. They get closer to each other, and she's in the hospital and she's the domestic. And she's given a choice of a few wards. Ruby, you can do that one, or that one. She said, I'll take that one. And that's the ward where John Richard King lay in a coma. And she went in and she started cleaning it. The walls are all white, the floor's white, the sheets are white. There's an Aboriginal woman with a white uniform on. John Richard King opens his eyes from the coma, sees her standing at the foot of the bed, and says, my goodness, I've died and gone to heaven and all the angels are Aboriginal. But he said he felt an instant attraction to her. She disputed that. But they got to know one another, and then Dad had to do what he knew he had to do, was seek permission from Dr. Cecil Cook, the protector of Aborigines, to allow Mum to go to the movies with him. And so once he got out of hospital, he got permission and they went to the Old Star Village here and went to the movies, and Dad said it was the most romantic night of his life. He said he knew then that this was going to be a great future. Mum said he went to sleep 5 minutes in and never said a word. But love conquers all. Love conquers all. And in the end, he decided that they should get married. And so he wrote to the protector of Aborigines again, and he said, I want to marry this woman. And at that time, ladies and gentlemen, the understanding is this. The non-Aboriginal person marries the Aboriginal woman. The deal is you don't take them back to their people. You don't take them back to their country. You don't encourage them to speak their language. So you try to cut the connection. That was the deal. That was the expectation. Not for John Richard King. As soon as they got married, he had a plan. I will take her back home. I'll take her back to Catherine. I'm not sure where Limbunya Station is. I'm not sure where the Kalkarindji or the Gringi people, but I know it's west. So they went back there and headed towards where Mum's family were. They got some horses in Catherine. I think it took them about over 3 to 4 weeks before they found where Mum's people were, and they found Tom. She was still alive, and she was so happy to see her daughter. And the daughter was so happy to see the mother that they settled down and stayed there for about a year, lived on country with his grandmother and Mum. And so Mum always said to us later on in life, the reason I'm never bitter about that is because I went back to my family. I went back and I spent time, and so did my husband, and we sat down with our people and we've come out of that much better people. She said, when things happen in your life, don't get bitter, get better. Do you know what? I've never forgotten that. Don't get bitter. Get better. And I try not to get bitter. I try to get better whenever I can when I think about things. So I was really proud of them. They got married, and there's a huge King dynasty in the Northern Territory. So they had 11 children, 8 girls and 3 boys. The boys, unfortunately, didn't produce any King children. So the name King is going to end now, our name King, unless, of course, my present daughter keeps her name, which she might, because maybe she's a bit rebellious. I don't know. So I'm going to introduce her to you. Her name's Emma King. She's 13.
Hello. Yes, I do think I'll be keeping my name. So the most rebellious thing I've done recently is actually tell this entire story when my dad told me not to. So when I was about 7, I was in a cafe and some Aboriginal people came in, and the people in the shop told them that they had to leave. They were not allowed in there. And I remember I was 7 and I was so confused. Like, why are people that look like my dad, they look like my nana, why are they being told to leave for no reason? I was confused, but I also knew that it was wrong, and that helped me, that sort of pushed me onto this path of always like standing up for what I believe in, and also like standing up for people who don't have a voice to like stand up for themselves. And so like because of this, I'm usually the most outspoken person in my class. But that's because like whenever I see racism or sexism, I call it out. Like it's become a reflex for me whenever I hear it. Like that's just what I do. And so just recently, a kid in my class made a racist joke and my reflex, you know, called him out on it. And he said to me, I've been told this before, why can't you just take a joke? And I was like, well, yeah, I can take a joke. That wasn't a joke. You're dehumanizing Aboriginal people. It's different. It's not funny. Sometimes when I'm talking to adults about things like sexism or racism, they'll tell me that we live in Australia, like we live in a first world country. That's not needed here. Like racial activism, feminism, that's not necessary here because we all have the same rights. But it is needed here. As a 13-year-old Aboriginal girl, I can tell you that sexism and racism does exist here. I see it. And like when I'm driving down the street and I see a car with the CU and the NT sticker on the back of it, I'm reminded that I live in a society that accepts sexism and it accepts racism. So my dad didn't want me to tell this story because he thought I might become like more of a target at school. But that's not in my nature to like be quiet about these sorts of things. Like I have to speak up about it. I just have to, you know? And that comes from my nana and pop, and that comes from my mum, and it comes from my dad, who spent his life doing that.
That story was told by Charlie and Emma King. It was produced by Kylie Stevenson. Charlie and Emma told this story at Spun, a live storytelling night presented by Story Projects in the Northern Territory. You can subscribe to the Spun Stories podcast and find out more about the Spun Storytelling Project by visiting spunstories.net. You can also look for Spun Stories on Facebook and Twitter. Last year, Charlie received the Northern Territory Senior Australian of the Year Award. In 2015, he was awarded an Order of Australia Medal for his service to broadcast media and the Indigenous community. All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. This episode was mixed and compiled by Alina Godwin. Our executive producer is Ryan Pemberton. Jordan Fennell is our Victorian State Coordinator. The All the Best Community Coordinators are Chloe Gillespie and Danny Stewart. Our SYN Community Coordinator is Lee Robinson. Matilda Fay is our social media producer, and I'm your host, Maddie McQueen. Shining Bird composed our theme music and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. We're heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and we're made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. You can find all of our episodes at allthebestradio.com. We're also a podcast, so subscribe.